Welcome to Afterthoughts, everybody. This is our recommend or refute episode. You know exactly how this functions. We go around the table, we say a movie that we've watched recently or a TV show. It can be a TV show. Ryan always insists it can't for some reason. We've broken that several times if that is the rule. And then we tell you if you should watch it or if you should, you know, avoid it. If anybody tries to put it on at a party, if you should walk away, just leave that party. Those aren't your friends anymore. I am your host, John Garcia. Joining me on this episode is our usual, Michael Dixon.
What's up, John? Excited to talk about what I watched recently.
Hell yeah. And our guest, Parker.
How's it going, everyone? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you, buddy. We'll kick things off with Dixon. Why don't you tell us what you got going? What you got for this week?
Yeah, so this week I watched a 1930s gangster film that I had been wanting to watch for a long time. And there wasn't really a good restoration of it. I think there was like a DVD version that wasn't very good. And then Criterion put it out on 4K and I bought it in their last flash sale. It's 1939's The Roaring Twenties.
Today's headlines tell a harrowing story of a world gone mad. As I read these headlines, I sometimes wonder how many people recall another astounding era in our recent history, ushered in by a similar period of world madness. It was a dangerous, lawless, high-tension era that will grow more and more incredible with each passing year, until someday people will say it never could have happened at all. At the time, I was writing a column for a New York newspaper, so I covered the most fantastic episode in American history, the Roaring Twenties. Now, those amazing days are recreated for you in Warner Brothers' vivid picturization of that dynamic period.
I'd always heard like, oh, this is like a really great film, and you know, it was hard to find, and so I was waiting for a good version of it to come out, and so I watched the 4K a few days ago and was very impressed with it. It was directed by Raoul Walsh, starring James Cagney, Priscilla Lane, and Humphrey Bogart. I had seen James Cagney in a gangster movie from the early 30s called Public Enemy, and I didn't really like that movie. And it had, you know, it's very acclaimed as like one of the better 30s gangster films, and didn't really like it. And so I hadn't returned to Cagney in quite a while, but I'd heard so many good things about this movie, and Humphrey Bogart is in it, and I love Humphrey Bogart. So I decided, all right, I need to check this out. Roaring Twenties starts in World War One, and James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and one other guy kind of all fall into the same foxhole in World War One and meet each other and kind of become war buddies. Lloyd Hart plays the other guy. And they then, you know, kind of become friends during the war. The war ends and they all go their separate ways. And then we really follow James Cagney. And Humphrey Bogart kind of disappears from the movie for a while. Cagney comes back to America and he wants to go back and work at the auto body shop that he used to work at. But coming back from the war, he finds that that auto body shop doesn't have any jobs available. And he goes around trying to find other work in any way he can. And he just can't, he can't figure out a job. He can't make it in, you know, 1920s America. So he ends up, he has a friend who is a cab driver, and his buddy's like, hey, I drive this cab 12 hours a day. The other 12 hours, the cab's just sitting there. Like, you want to drive my cab during the other 12 hours? Go for it. So starts driving his cab around, ends up picking up a bootlegger at one point, and he's like, hey, can you deliver this booze to this bar? And that ends up being kind of an entry point for him to get into the bootlegging business, mm-hmm. and ends up kind of building up a bootlegging empire. And as most gangster films go, he rises to success and then, you know, falls toward the end of the film. At one point, he meets back up with Humphrey Bogart randomly by accident, who has been smuggling booze in from Scotland, and decides like, hey, I have been making bathtub gin and it's kind of shit, but like, if you can get the goods from overseas, then we can partner up. You know the source, I have the distribution, let's partner together. Meanwhile, he falls in love with a woman played by Priscilla Lane, who was writing letters to him during the war. It's like she had just like picked a soldier to write to kind of keep him, you know, feeling appreciated. And then he comes back to America and, you know, kind of gets a crush on this woman and tries to pursue her as a love interest. The Roaring Twenties, like if you watch it now, it feels kind of like a by the numbers gangster film, but that's because it's been so influential. I've seen a few gangster films from before this, Little Caesar and Public Enemy, and they're not anywhere near the quality that The Roaring Twenties is. It's just such an impeccably made movie. And Martin Scorsese is a big fan of this movie, and you can really see it as you're watching this movie. It feels almost like the plot of Casino. Like there is a guy who is getting into the gangster life and moving up through the ranks, and he has a friend who has less morals than him, who, you know, there's like stories of betrayal and unrequited love and things like that that are very present in the Casino script and in lots of Scorsese gangster films. And I really enjoyed it. I thought Cagney in Public Enemy was kind of flat and not very interesting. He's incredible in The Roaring Twenties as a guy who is kind of just trying to figure out how to make it and, you know, ends up getting corrupted by money and power, as most people are, and ends up suffering the ramifications of that. It's a really fascinating Bogart performance. This was 1939. This is before Casablanca, before The Big Sleep, before The Maltese Falcon, these roles that really push Bogart up into this movie star status. And up until then, he was doing a lot of bit parts. And he plays just this incredibly evil person in this movie who is just out for himself, doesn't trust anybody, will fuck anybody over to move up in society. And pitting him against James Cagney is really interesting, where Cagney's character has some level of morals and, you know, he's willing to break the law and to do other things, but he has, you know, kind of an everyman quality to him where he's willing to take advantage of the system, but he's only willing to go so far. And Bogart is kind of the Joe Pesci character in the movie that is just kind of fucking insane and just willing to do anything to get where he wants to go, which is not like the normal Bogart character that you think of. Is kind of cynical and morally compromised, but has some sort of moral center to him.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see signs of that character in The Roaring Twenties, but it's not who he would end up becoming frequently in his films in the 40s. But yeah, I really enjoyed The Roaring Twenties. It is just an incredible movie, a really great script, incredibly shot and directed and acted and just very well done. I feel like it's a film from 1939 that, you know, people always talk about 1939. It's like, oh, this was just such an incredible year for cinema. And people talk about The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind and other movies from that era. And this is one that isn't mentioned as often that I think is as good or better than any of those films and definitely worth people going to check out.
Yeah, is Gone with the Wind really still a good movie?
I have seen it once and did not like it. So never can say. I love The Wizard of Oz, but I don't think Gone with the Wind is good. I think like it's
replace it with
long and racist and not very interesting.
But. Oh, like America's History.
Yeah.
Actually, it's very interesting, I would say. It's long and racist.
Perfect for American cinema.
When did you first like hear about The Roaring Twenties? Was it like did you find a list of like top movies or was it just some other?
I first heard about this, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. Is like, oh, this The Roaring Twenties is just, you know, one of the best things the studio system in Hollywood ever did, but it's really hard to find. And if you can watch it, it's not, you know, it's not a good transfer. It's kind of shitty. And so I had always been waiting, like, surely somebody's going to restore this at some point. And then Criterion did. I was like, oh, great. I'm going to buy that and watch it. And I'm very glad I did. It was a great experience.
And the restoration was good.
Yeah. The restoration was incredible. You know, sometimes you have old movies that are restored in 4K or in high definition, and it's like, they can only do what they can with the source material, right? Where, you know, some scenes look good and some scenes look pretty shitty. This looked pretty great throughout. There were some scenes that looked better than others. You know, at its peak, it was like, holy shit, that is some of the most detail I've ever seen in a piece of black and white cinema. And other scenes not rendered quite as well, but, you know, they're doing what they can. The restoration was done from the original camera negative and a safety negative and kind of combined to get the best version of it that they could. But it looks great. It was really well done. And the sound came through really well, too. Sometimes with these older movies, you get a lot of white noise coming through on the soundtrack, and it sounded great.
Nice. Well, rad. I tried to look it up and I accidentally looked up. You have to spell out 20s, everybody. I looked up the boring 20s with 2 and 0 and just gave you like Mick Jagger's glory years, the boring 20s. And like, I was like, that's probably not the movie you're talking about. I don't think we did that. Very nice.
Yeah, and Priscilla Lane is in a few other movies around the time. She kind of had a few years where she was a big star and then stopped working. But she's in Arsenic and Old Lace and Saboteur and some other big films from that era. But I think this was kind of her first big breakout role, and she's really great as kind of a singer who wants to make it, and you know, is accepting Cagney's advances as far as it will get her jobs, but mm-hmm. isn't, you know, really interested in that relationship. And there's a very interesting love triangle aspect of the film that works really well. And Cagney is an interesting actor where he was very influential. Cagney's work was influential on The Shining. Mm-hmm. Like Kubrick really loved Cagney and wrote Jack Torrance in the idea that he would be kind of this unhinged, crazy figure that Cagney plays in a lot of gangster roles. And so, you know, you see a bit of Nicholson in what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's pretty interesting to watch.
Yeah. Nice.
Nice. Well, Parker, what do you have for us?
So I recently watched Priscilla, the new movie that came out last year by Sofia Coppola.
Hi. What's your name?
Priscilla Boyer.
You like Elvis Presley?
Of course. Who doesn't?
What are the kids listening to these days?
Bobby Darin, Fabian, and you.
Just what is the intent here, Mr. Presley? You got women throwing themselves at you. Why my daughter?
Well, sir, I happen to be very fond of your daughter. She's much more mature than her age. Black hair and more eye makeup.
I don't know if I like it.
What do you mean you don't know if you like it?
He's not like you imagine. You know, there's a lot of rumors about you.
Was there something you're hiding?
I don't have a goddamn thing to hide. I need a woman who understands that things like this might happen. Are you going to be her or not?
It follows Priscilla Presley's life before she was Priscilla Presley. Her meeting Elvis and, you know, starting that relationship and going through their marriage, kind of. It is just a very like somber movie. One of those movies that you kind of have to go into just like ready to be super depressed and down throughout the entire thing. It's a little kind of like eerie and tense throughout a lot of pieces of it as well. It goes throughout Priscilla and Elvis meeting in Germany while Elvis was living, was doing military work during the war on an army base. And she was underage at the time. And so like they kind of have to like be careful about their relationship. But it's like very clear that like, you know, they there is this like, you know, tension between them. And like the movie definitely portrays Priscilla as like trying to push towards being in that kind of situation. Like she asks her parents to like let her go out and be a part of these things and like go and stay at his place whenever he goes back to Graceland. And there is just kind of like this like weird struggle between like the parents and Elvis, but like, it's not like a power struggle really. Like it's just kind of like a giving up of innocence almost. And then the movie just kind of progresses from there and Elvis kind of, it's very interesting. It's showing Elvis in a much different light than a lot of the movies that like recently came out with mm-hmm. that biopic and yep. And everything else that like we've known about him and their relationship together. You know, people know that they get separated, but it's not as clear like what was going on, and it kind of is seen as like, you know, Elvis just becoming too big. But the movie is so interesting. Like he's very enamored with her at the beginning. Until he's able to like establish a foothold on her. Mm-hmm. And the whole movie is very much like a just a very, very dense look at a power dynamic and a struggle in a relationship that has like such a huge gap in the power levels between like a teenage girl versus, you know, a world famous superstar. Mm-hmm. And the movie definitely keeps that like tension going throughout it. Like even in the wedding scene, you're sitting there just kind of like on pins and needles. It's very quiet. There's just like very little music in the background. It's really interesting. Elvis is played by Jacob Elordi. And he does a really great job just like, you know, imbuing that kind of like that charm that Elvis had with people. He very much is like able to like win people over, including Priscilla's parents. But then like he has this like very like deep darkness to him that like you see just come out like at like weird random times. And you'll see him like use like very like without being like physical, he'll like, there's a situation where they're like in an argument and she's finally like expressing like some kind of like doubt in like his love for her. And like, he just straight up is like, I think we should separate for a little while. I think we need to just like,
yeah,
you know, disconnect from each other. And then like, you know, we'll come back to this later. And he like does that obviously as a way to make her stop and like go like, oh wait, no, I don't want to separate.
It's like a manipulative play.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so the movie just kind of goes throughout that, in a lot of different ways. Like he's very obsessed with her at the beginning. And then once like he's able to like, you know, pretty much gain control of her, he gets her pregnant and then he literally like just does not like touch her or like interact with her in a lot of different ways for like 4, 5, 6 years. And like the movie just like shows like that progression of her like just becoming like disconnected from everything. So it's a very tense movie, but it's like very well directed, very well well shot. Everything is very beautiful. It looks like perfectly through the 50s and 60s. Like all of the set pieces look perfect. And like there's like this beauty behind all of like Priscilla's outfits and everything, and this beauty in the way that like she's portrayed. And then just like completely counteracted by like all of the pain that she feels whenever she like separates from Elvis and realizes that she is going through like such a difficult thing.
Yeah, it kind of captures that like facade of their relationship that is portrayed in any other media.
Exactly.
Like, and then actually adds depth beyond it.
Yeah.
When does Tom Hanks come in?
The best thing about Priscilla is that Colonel whatever his
Colonel
fucking
Parker?
Name is Colonel yeah. Tom Parker is not yeah. in the movie.
Yeah. You love a man who is reaching for the rock of eternity, Priscilla. He can never reach it.
There's one scene where Elvis is talking to Tom Parker on the phone.
Yeah.
And but that's it. That's the only thing you get.
Okay, good. Good to know.
No, it's pretty good. And it shows like, you know, like all of the fervor and fandom that Elvis had around him. She like serves him divorce papers and she goes and says goodbye to like all the people at Graceland and she leaves and like the fans just stay at Graceland watching and everything. And nobody like pays her any more attention. And it's just very like, it's very interesting. Like the ideas and concepts she had going into the relationship and then, you know, how she felt coming afterwards.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
I enjoy anything that is willing to deconstruct like beyond the pop culture representation of a relationship. Like I appreciate Sofia Coppola adding depth to that, especially hot on the heels of Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, which is very much like, here's all the greatest hits and like, check out Austin Butler swinging it around, like whatever. Which I enjoyed that movie for what it is. I think that Tom Hanks is hilarious as whatever kind of elf he's trying to be from another country, is like a Dutch elf or something.
No one knows, some sort of vaguely Eastern European dipshit.
That movie is way more of a jukebox like experience.
And yeah, it's much more for the music.
You're there for the music and like Baz Luhrmann's insane editing. And then everything beyond that is like, okay, sure. But this, it sounds like there's a lot more of the, there's a lot of moral questions to this. And it's not just she was like underage and that's wrong. It's like she wanted to get into this relationship and here's like all the fucking shit that comes with it. Like
yeah.
all of the tendrils.
And not to say that that is still not a wrong relationship. Yeah, very yeah, much yeah. a exactly. wrong thing. Mm-hmm. But like it is, it's just very interesting that like it is something that she pushed for mm-hmm. and Elvis, like it's so wild. You know, you talk about these people that have like a lot of charisma and like people don't want to think of Elvis as like a cult leader, but like definitely there's a cult is. Of personality around like these people, like even Taylor Swift today, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's very hard for like fans to want to question that. So those people have a lot of power just immediately. And yeah. like, especially with somebody like Elvis, they show him to be like, just like, literally like talking to him is like talking to the sun, you know, like yeah. you're getting direct light of pure energy focused on you. So like, why would you not want that all the time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Priscilla. I think it's a very interesting companion piece with Elvis. If you have already seen Elvis, I would not recommend anyone watch Elvis who has not already seen it. like just an absolute piece of shit movie, but
I would recommend you
biopic maybe.
But Priscilla, I think is really interesting. Like if you have seen Elvis, seeing that relationship portrayed from Priscilla's perspective, right? Like Coppola really focuses on Priscilla's youth and naivete as she is going into this. And like mm-hmm. in the Lerman film, he portrays Priscilla as just like an adult who can make her own decisions. And that's yeah. not who she was, yeah. right? She was like 15 when mm-hmm. Elvis met her. And, I think it's a really interesting portrayal of domestic abuse and, you know, like emotional domestic abuse.
Yes.
And I think Coppola is a really interesting filmmaker where she's very talented and she has a very reserved quality in her films that really accentuate the actors and the performances and, mm-hmm. and the characters that you're seeing. And she does a very good job of just kind of showing these two people in this relationship and letting you kind of take from it what you will.
Yeah, it's being in like just letting the space breathe.
Yeah.
You know, letting the actors mm-hmm. breathe and then you being able to interpret it from there. You're not having to have it spoon-fed to you. She's just giving you, here is a picture. Take the 1,000 words that you want from it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the cast is really good in this movie. Oh, like, yeah. I think Jacob Elordi is a much better Elvis than Austin Butler yeah. was.
And he didn't have to go crazy for it.
Yeah. yeah. And Kaylee Spaney as Priscilla is she just does an incredible.
Amazing, amazing job.
Yeah.
And yeah, I am recommending that. What about you, John?
I'm going to have to check it out because I like Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann movie.
because you're a psychopath,
I love
John.
How insane that's... it is.
yeah. This is going to be the exact opposite. Of
mm-hmm. I mean, it is one of, well, yeah, they seem like very much in opposition because this is going to be a somber, much more grounded film, mm-hmm. it sounds like.
And stylistically, just incredibly yeah, the opposite.
And yeah. Baz Luhrmann's has a whole scene with women like creaming in the fucking audience for Elvis. And it's like very much intense orgasms happening man. Everywhere. yeah. well, I want to talk about a movie that I haven't seen since I was a kid. And it's, well, one, I should say, I watched Godzilla X Kong over the weekend, and if anybody, or actually this past week, and if anybody is interested in seeing my review, go to my letterbox. It's Loose Cannon Cop, C-A-N-O-N, that can of cannon, not the Dirty Harry Loose Cannon. yeah, and feel free to give me your opinion on my sequel that I've written for them.
Your letterbox review was very good, John. I would definitely recommend people read it. I have not seen the movie.
I
probably
won't.
Yeah.
I know exactly how you'd react to it. And mm-hmm. I sighed a lot during it, and I was like, Dixon would sigh significantly more.
yeah. It just seemed like too much CGI for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. But anyways, that's not the movie I want to talk about. I just wanted to give an honorable or dishonorable mention to it, whatever. The movie I do want to talk about is 1994's The Pagemaster.
From the creator of An American Tale.
You're in need of adventure.
Wow. Whatever you imagine.
All is possible.
20th Century Fox presents Macaulay Culkin as you've never seen him before.
Look at this place!
On a fantastic journey into a land of endless wonders. where he'll scale the heights of the world's greatest adventures.
Moby Dick! LCB Treasure Island!
Happy birthday!
And bring back the ultimate prize.
You've got to fight to make a wish come true.
That's it, boy!
His own courage.
Yes!
Which is a hybrid animated live action movie starring Macaulay Culkin. And it comes in at a tight 75 minutes. It's a low commitment kind of film. It's definitely a middle of the road movie. Like it's not going to knock your socks off, but it is like just fun to watch with friends and just a good time. If you watch it on your own for a first time, it's probably entertaining. The thing I love most about it is it's the best public library propaganda I've seen in a long time.
Okay.
Very much like a read a book funded by the government kind of vibe I got from it. The whole premise is Macaulay Culkin is like an 8-year-old nerd who thinks about statistics and how his dad could die if he does anything with his hardware tools all the time. And he constantly is like, I'm not going to take risks, Dad, because I'm a little weenie boy who doesn't like to do things outside of staying at home and doing my homework. And his dad is like, fucking whatever. I'm trying to build you a treehouse so that you can have fun and be a child. And he's like, I don't want a treehouse, Dad. Statistically, like 19 out of 20 kids die if they live in a treehouse or some shit. And you're like, fuck off.
It's probably true if you actually live permanently in a treehouse.
Yeah, those are different ones. Those are the ones in the Sequoias. And so like his dad's like, whatever, why don't you go get me some nails from the hardware store? It's just ride your bike 40 miles through this like rainstorm that's coming in and like this dark tunnel. It's his dad sends him off on like a very unsafe odyssey. I have no idea where they live.
Go grab a bunch of sharp things and bring them back to me.
Yeah. Ride your children's tricycle through this like terrible terrain.
It like seems like colonial New England, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, somewhere there. And he gets caught in a lightning, in a thunderstorm and like fucking lightning and everything drives him to this gigantic library. It's like a massive labyrinth of books. Like, I didn't even know where would have this kind of thing. Cause they have literally the ceilings are like 3 or 4 stories and there's no second level. You just grab a ladder and go up.
Oh Jesus.
Like that kind of fucking wild. Okay. Cause you could just do this. And Christopher Lloyd is a well-meaning librarian who just seems like a pedophile.
Welcome to the library, young man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, stop. Allow me to guess. I have a talent for guessing what people need. You're in need of a fantasy.
It's just immediately he's like, God. I know what you're here for, little boy. Why don't you come with me into the back rows? And you're like,
Marty, get in my DeLorean. Yeah, we gotta get out of here.
It's your kids, Marty. the moment you see him, you're like, he seems like he's desperate for anybody to come into the library, and it makes the dynamic he has with the small child very uncomfortable because he's like, you don't have a library card? That's okay. I'll give you a library card. Here you go. And like,
that is what librarians say nowadays too.
And so like from there, he kind of like leads Macaulay Culkin into the heart of the labyrinth of all of these books. And he's like, he's like, I just want to call my dad. I don't give a fuck about books. I just want to call my dad and tell him to come get me. It's a dangerous outside, whatever. And he's like, all right, well, the phone is all the way at the back of the library. Take a right here. And like,
does he have to go up the ladder all the way to the top?
Yeah, it's kind of like that shit where you're like, what the fuck? Why would there be that? And the entire time he's saying this, there's like 4 phones around him at the like librarian's desk he's at. He could easily let him use, but he won't. So
he's gotta go to the payphone.
Yeah. So Mac, he wanders on back to the end and he slips and falls because there's like a leak in like this big atrium. And it like fucking hits his head hard on the back of the ground and just blacks out. And when he wakes up, the library comes to life and there's like this early CGI, like there's like murals of like dragons and shit above all the fantasy. And I'm like, there's no way that this is a real library. This is too immaculate and like awesomely constructed. And like the entire ceiling just starts melting and all the colors drive him deeper into the library where he finds like 3 living books that are voiced by Sir Patrick Stewart.
Oh no.
And he's doing a pirate's voice.
Can we get going now?
Aye, aye. Let's scale this mast and get our bearings.
Mast? That's a lad.
And you can't tell it's Sir Patrick Stewart most of the time. He does a really good job.
Voice.
Yeah, he does a really good job of being that. And then Whoopi Goldberg, who is... Sir Patrick Stewart is an adventurer, so an adventure book, so he's a pirate.
British.
Whoopi Goldberg is a fairy godmother book.
I'm fantasy. Oh, I'm fantasy.
Tells legends and fairy tales. And then Frank Welker, who is a famous voice actor. He's a god in voice acting, who did Fred on Scooby-Doo.
Gee whiz, gang. Looks like the killer gutted the victim, strangled him with his own intestines, and then dumped the body in the river. You're right, Scoob. We're dealing with one sick son of a bitch.
And like has been a lot of characters in Futurama and pretty much anything that you've seen with voice actors, like Frank Welker's in it.
Hmm.
He plays the horror book, who's just this like Frankenstein's book, basically. Mm-hmm. He has like stitches and he's really doofy.
Bunch of random books sewn together.
And he's like terrified of everything. And it's and it quickly becomes this like procedural where they have to go through all three of their genres to get to the exit of the library and call his parents. And that's when it's fully animated at that point. It just becomes like they're going through Treasure Island. They have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They have, a dragon. It's just a generic dragon. It's not anything else for the fantasy world. And it very much is like that. Oh, you know, you can really get lost in these books and you can have these stories and journeys and, it's overly positive and it teaches the kid the usual arc of like, hey, the magic was inside you all along and maybe you should come back to the library and check out books and learn more and have experiences that like actively drive your growth as a person. And so I align with the movie in the philosophy of the stories are important. The stories you read can change who you are and like can impact you. And the action and the animation is for the most part really well done. It feels like sort of like a Don Bluth style movie done on a little bit lower of a budget. And so it's not anything that you're going to like write home about. But it's a good watch and it makes you want to read a book. It makes you more enthusiastic to read a book. Mm-hmm. As it made me like be like, oh, I kind of do want to like go crack something open after this movie and not because the movie was awful. it was fun. It's a good time. I didn't remember seeing it as a kid. I just remembered having those books. I really liked the animated portion with the books, but live action is fine too. It gets through the live action in like 15 minutes. It's like, fuck that. Let's get right into the animated part and then let's get right back out.
Does he make it home to his dad with the nails?
He makes it home to his dad with the books, which they don't build a treehouse with books, but it ends with like the books are all just kind
books
of
are
like
just trees,
regular books. Yeah. But then when he's alone, they become alive books again. And I was like, all right,
a Toy Story thing.
Yeah. I was like, I'm down for whatever this metaphor is. Yeah. So, but I also like it because it has a lot of child endangerment as a film. There's a lot of scenes where the kid's almost about to be killed or drowned or shot. And I'm like,
love seeing kids die.
They really went for it. They really like, it's got some surprising cast choices too. Like Leonard Nimoy is in it playing like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And
I like that casting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They add like a few others where they're like, yeah, let's just like throw this person in as whoever the fuck in Treasure Island. And you're like, all right, sure. Why not? Fuck
I'll
it.
Roll with it.
Like, cool.
My work here is done.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything.
<It's> exactly.
Didn't I?
Didn't I? But yeah. So, I mean, it's a fun movie. It's great propaganda for public libraries. Public libraries have so much to offer us in their services, and library cards are pretty inexpensive. You can even rent like films from like MUBI, I think.
Aren't they free? Aren't library cards free?
Library cards are free. I thought that there was a cost that came with them.
There's no cost. You can sign up for free.
Not yet. There's not.
And you can actually rent power tools. So he could have helped his dad build that.
You know, you can rent power tools now.
You absolutely can.
You can use the internet there. You can rent DVDs. They have Criterion movies, I'm pretty sure.
Shout outs to libraries. There are only third spaces that we have left in this world. Yeah. I remember that movie as a kid. It was really great and very fun. I remember renting it a few times. Mm-hmm. It was, it was part of that like late 80s, early 90s, push for inclusivity for kids and like doing like good public services and stuff. So I always have like a bit of nostalgia for those, and it's good.
Yeah. It's nice to know when I went back to it that I wasn't completely bored and I wasn't also like, oh, come on, why are they doing this?
Yeah.
It was genuinely a fun ride, and watching Macaulay Culkin be endangered several times was fun.
Yeah, always fun. That was another theme of those kids action movies.
Sure. It's like the pirates from Treasure Island were gonna like shoot him and bury his corpse.
Oh my
a bunch
God.
Of that shit where you're like, holy fuck, they're really gonna do it.
Speaking of, and slightly tangential, but I remember seeing a tweet about the Pagemaster recently, so I'm just gonna read that out really quick.
Go for it.
To preface, there was a big push for Hear Me Out online recently, where people would post like who they thought was hot, a hot take. So they would post like, you know, wait, hear me out, you know. And so this tweet is, God, I love when men's Hear Me Out is a photo of an objectively hot woman. Meanwhile, a woman's Hear Me Out is like the pirate book from the Pagemaster.
Yes.
And it perfectly encapsulated that entire little fad, because it was definitely just women like doing some dudes that we were like, oh, okay. What's his name? Just did a Saltburn.
Barry Keoghan.
Barry Keoghan. Dudes are always just going to post hotties for some dumb reason.
Nobody's going to post the Frank Welker horror book.
Yeah.
But yeah. Hear me out. Beyonce is attractive.
Whoa. Hey.
The Ice Age takes of the century.
Hold on there.
I will say, just another tangent back to Godzilla X Kong real quick, because I remembered how stupid. I love that entire franchise's dedication to misappropriating scientific theories and just steamrolling accepted stuff. That they now in this new one added that there was a kaiju that caused the Ice Age that wiped out whatever, and that it has always been in Hollow Earth. And was subjugated by a monkey king. And that's why it caused the Ice Age.
Sure. Why not?
It's just like, just fuck it. At this point, yeah, fuck it. I don't care. And that's why we need public libraries where people can read actual educational resources.
That's funny. Man. When I was a kid, we had like a massive bookcase full of like animated VHS tapes, like the Disney clamshell stuff and all that. And I have never heard of this movie until just now. It came out in 94, and that's when The Lion King came out, I believe, which was like, I loved that movie as a kid, and I, you know, watched all kind of stuff from that era, but I have never heard of this. So I did love Home Alone, you know, another Macaulay Culkin vehicle.
Yeah.
And Joe Pesci.
Full circle.
Well, let me know if you decide at any point you'd want to check out Pagemaster.
It's always a fun ride. Are.
Again, child endangerment. It's the best plot driving device in any movie I've seen, from Cloak and Dagger to Daryl to this.
Honestly,
it's great.
If you just follow up the Pagemaster with Stand By Me, you have the reason why, you know, Macaulay Culkin dies in that movie. Because no one's watching that kid ever.
Oh man. Well, yeah, that's a recommendation for the Pagemaster. So, and any other questions y'all have about that? I feel like it's pretty laid out.
Yeah. What percentage of the movie is animated versus live action?
It's
roughly
about 85% of the movie.
Is animated. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Cause it's like literally like 15 minutes of live action at the beginning, and then 5 minutes toward the end. That's like, all right. And then he's back home, and fuck it. He's at the books. And then everything else is him just being animated, trying to do stuff.
It's like a less depressing Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And really, that kid, he's probably still dead. There's probably some Jacob's Ladder shit. He cracked his head on the floor and he's bleeding out. nobody saved him in that.
Oh, man.
They cut that scene from the end of the movie. Like, you know what? We got to reshoot the ending.
We got to make it more hopeful. Like, his dad actually cared about him and built that treehouse instead of sending him to his death.
The librarian's just trying to figure out how to hide a dead body.
Yeah.
What book could I read?
Shove them in the books.
Nobody comes into this wing of the library. Just throw them back there. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah, there's a recommendation for the Pagemaster. With that, I think we can safely close this recommend or review it out. It was a pretty unanimous recommendations around the table, but from different experiences. Again, we have the Roaring Twenties, which did not get shot in the Roaring Twenties. It was shot in
1939 when it was released. Anyway, I don't know if it was shot in that year, but
I feel like they just would railroad those for like 6 weeks and throw them out at the same time.
Yeah.
So maybe high chance.
Production was short.
So yeah, recommendation for the Roaring Twenties. We have a recommendation for Priscilla and the darker side of the relationship that she shared with Elvis.
And I'm just going to refute Elvis again, just so everyone out there can hear it.
He's trying to balance
watch that movie.
He's balancing me out because I'm out there recommending Elvis to unsuspecting people and telling them it's great. Tom Hanks gives a fantastic performance.
John, you are a cinema terrorist. Just recommending people fuck up their weekends watching this movie.
That's his favorite thing to do.
You need me, Dixon, so that you can be out there driving people to good cinema. and then I'm over here recommending child endangerment in films
in films alone
as a driving force with the Pagemaster, and also just public library propaganda. Get more people in public libraries.
Yeah.
They keep adding, they make smoking look cool. Why can't they make like shootouts happen in a library and you're saved by cool books? Come on, John Wick, get in there. Hit more some real people with a bunch of tomes.
Books hurt, okay?
Yeah, they're fucking heavy. So, yeah. And with that, we'll close this episode out. Thank you all for listening. I've been your host, John Garcia. Joining me, our guest,
Parker Curtis.
And also with us, as always,
Michael Dixon.
Thanks for putting up with Elvis. Hey there, movie buffs, TV toughs, and all listeners in between. John here from the Afterthoughts podcast. I just wanted to drop in at the end of this episode and say thanks for listening. If you've got afterthoughts of your own to share, hit us up. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Afterpod, or jump into a conversation on our Discord server. You can find info for this and more at theafterpod.transistor.fm. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.